Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Nate Mattson had had enough.
And I just said that this can't go down like this. This can't be what happens anymore.
He was outraged because loggers were cutting down beautiful old redwood forests in Humboldt County, California, where he lived. Months of protests had not stopped the saws. This was the late 90s. Nate was in college. He was really involved in environmental causes.
You know, what some people have dubbed the timber wars.
An activist had recently died when he tried to stop loggers and a tree fell on him.
One of our friends was killed by a falling tree yesterday.
Nate heard about this on the radio. It affected him deeply. And he decided to do something radical.
And so that night, I went out and walked around in the redwoods where they had marked the trees for cutting, but had not yet begun to cut.
He was going to live in one of those giant trees marked for death and protected with his constant presence. He made arrangements, gathered supplies, and returned a few days later.
When I got back the actual night when I climbed up into Moriah, she was the only one that was remaining.
And did you name her that?
I did.
And why?
It was after the old... I don't even know the name of the song, but there's an old folk song that goes, Moriah, Moriah, they call the wind Moriah.
Wind Moriah.
And, you know, forgive my singing voice. I knew right away when I got up there that the wind was going to be an intense part of the experience. And so I named her Moriah.
So you climb up in there and what? You build a little house? What did you do next?
The first couple of nights, I just stayed on branches, and that became very obviously inadequate as far as a living arrangement goes.
So I've seen that, like, in the Hunger Games. But how do you actually do that?
So I was able to take some other branches and lay them across that even plane and built, you know, what I will describe as a nest, although that's a little bit generous. It was more of a, you know... a stick conglomerate.
Eventually, Nate built a sturdy platform in the tree, over 100 feet up in the air. And that must feel terrifying, right?
It's not that bad, because the tree would bend with the wind and then kind of be held in place. Whereas on gusty, you know, it could be a much lighter wind, and then it'd be gustier, and then you would get blown back and forth. And yes, that got a little scary for sure.
He stayed up there for almost 2 years. His friends supplied him with food and water. They took away his waste. It got lonely at times, wet and cold, but he felt like he needed to protect the tree and bring attention to the potential loss of this beautiful forest. Nate spread the word about his mission from high up in the tree, and he even kept doing classwork for college with his first-generation cell phone. So was it like T9 function, like boop, 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 like that kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, typing with your thumbs.
Visitors would come. They used a rope to climb up into the tree.
It was one of the more amazing parts of the experience was sharing it. It was a really neat thing to see that light in people's eyes light up. And it was interesting because you could always see it happen. It was like when we were sitting on the platform and they would see a bird or a, you know, whatever, some kind of trigger. And you could just see them get it. It was like, bing, they got it.
What Nate wanted people to get was that special connection that humans have with trees. You know that feeling of taking a deep breath when you're in a beautiful forest, or the serenity when you look up into the leafy green canopy of a huge tree? Maybe we feel that because trees connect us to some primal part of our existence. We breathe more deeply in their presence because we can't breathe or live on this planet without them. Trees produce oxygen, they filter water, they shade us from the rays of the sun, and provide food and shelter. But trees are threatened by human activity. On this episode, we explore our relationship with trees and what scientists are learning about protecting them. With climate change, temperatures are becoming more extreme. Some places will have more droughts, others will have more floods. And those changing conditions really affect trees. Humans can move away from shorelines or flood and fire-prone areas. Trees are stuck, and they suffer the consequences. What does climate change mean for them, and what can we do about it? Alan Yu reports.
Right now, every tree is part of something like a global experiment. The climate is changing, so which trees will survive where? That's a question researchers are trying to figure out right now, but it's difficult. Growing a tree can take years, sometimes decades, and trees can stick around for decades or even more than 100 years. That means forest managers have to try and predict the impacts of climate change years in advance. And the stakes are high. Get it wrong, and you could end up with no trees, or an out-of-control train wreck of invasive species. If we want a glimpse of the future we want to avoid, we can look at eastern hemlock. It's a common, tall, kind of pyramid-shaped tree that grows all across Pennsylvania. It used to be so common that hemlock forests blocked out the sun.
So if you were to walk into a hemlock forest during summertime, it's almost like being in a cathedral of trees. It's very dark and cool.
That's Greg Sarnecki, the director of Applied Climate Science at the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. He says the cathedrals of hemlock trees provide habitat for songbirds, salamanders, and importantly, keep the streams and rivers cool for the brook trout and other fish. That water temperature matters a great deal for the fish and the multi-million dollar recreational fishing industry. But Greg says the hemlock is not going to last here.
You can go there and see that most of the hemlocks are dead. There are very tall, standing dead hemlock trees. Some of the trees in that area were close to 300 years old. So you can see a significant number of those large kind of skeletal remains of hemlocks.
The trees are dying because of warming temperatures, drought, and invasive insects that benefit from shorter winters. In the past, forest managers would try to preserve the forest, save the eastern hemlock, and keep it where it is. But Greg says the climate is changing so quickly, at such an unprecedented rate, that preservation battle has already been lost.
We kind of need a new conservation paradigm, one that looks at preserving the stage, but recognizing that the actors are going to change.
That means we want to keep forests as forests and wetlands as wetlands. But we have to accept that trees and animals that are there right now might not be there in the future and might even go extinct. Scientists need to figure out what trees would thrive in the new climate conditions and help them move. This is the kind of work Dave Muffley does now. He went to school for mechanical engineering, but then he got into environmentalism big time.
You know, I've spent quality times dumpster diving. I'm an expert dumpster diver from my, you know, intentional community days. It was Palo Alto. So, I mean, the food that ends up in the dumpster there is probably better than what a lot of people in the world eat.
Dave also did some nonprofit work, which included taking a job at Stanford planting oak trees. That was a challenge, because with more drought in California, a lot of native oak trees, tall trees that can reach up to 65 feet and last more than a century, were not doing well.
That's the saddest thing in the world to watch, is the death of the oaks. The leaves just fall off. You know, they start to turn yellow and they fall, and all that you're left with is this gray, twisted structure that used to be beautiful.
So Dave thought, what would California look like with climate change? He did the research and decided it would look like current-day New Mexico or Texas. He went to the Southwest and found oak trees that are close cousins to the dying native oaks of California. He brought some acorns back to California and planted them.
What's shocking is how well it's working. A lot of these new trees, these close cousin trees, they're working as well or even better than the historical species that have been used in coastal California.
Some biologists call this assisted migration.
We're just doing what nature would do if it had time and if the geology allows.
Then Dave got a call from Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, who wanted something like an urban forest for the Apple Park headquarters. That's the one that looks like a giant steel and glass spaceship.
Welcome, Mr. Jobs. This looks like you have a fan club here.
Thanks, yeah.
This is a 2011 city council meeting in Cupertino, California, that has been viewed more than 2 million times on YouTube. Steve Jobs gets up with his famous glasses and black turtleneck sweater and explains the site back then was mostly a giant parking lot, and he wanted it to be mostly trees.
And so I think the overall feeling of the place is going to be a zillion times better than it is now with all the asphalt.
Dave got the job of deciding which trees to plant, which boosted his family cred.
Oh my God, for 20 years, they weren't pleased at all. Then one day I got hired by Steve Jobs, proving that maybe I'd been onto something for all those years. And boy, suddenly I became popular in the family.
And Dave made it work. The Apple Park campus is now surrounded by oak trees, redwood trees, olive trees, and many more. Dave stresses that this is just one test in a kind of isolated urban area with the kind of budget that only Apple can provide. But researchers are doing this kind of work elsewhere, though maybe on a smaller scale and not always starting with a blank canvas of asphalt parking lots.
I'm supposed to get here so no one follows us in who shouldn't be driving in here.
I'm at Cobbs Creek Park on the outskirts of Philadelphia with Tom Whitman, operations manager for Natural Lands Restoration. A couple years ago, invasive plants had taken over this area and killed off native plants.
You can see it's a very large open area in here, what really should be covered with trees. So there's a huge canopy gap here that was dominated by invasive plants. And so this entire canopy gap was just a tangle of vines and shrubs.
Tom and his colleagues had to cut through all of it with chainsaws and mowers. And then they replanted, mostly with species native to Pennsylvania, but also with some species that are normally hundreds of miles south of here. That's why you can see pine trees and southern red oak, natives of the south or southeast.
The idea really is just to see how they'll fare in Philadelphia's climate. Will Philadelphia's climate moderate to the extent that these historically southern species can establish in Philadelphia?
In other words, will the climate change so quickly that a tree from the south could thrive here in the northeast?
14.5 feet is 439 centimeters.
I come back with some other foresters as they do their annual data collection to track how these trees are doing. They use a pole to measure how tall the trees are, a metal tape measure to see how widely the shrubs have spread, and a tool that looks like a small orange claw to measure how thick the tree stems are. The pine trees from the south are doing really well.
They've outgrown our range pole.
They've even grown some pine cones, and there's a tiny new pine tree close by, which was definitely not planted as part of the experiment. Other trees are not doing so well.
So maybe it got smashed when this tree fell, broke a branch of it off.
20 to 30% of the trees have died, which is in line with other tree plantings. Tom says, give it another 5 years, then we'll have some answers. Remember, tree research grows slowly.
That was Alan Yu reporting. And these changes with trees, they are happening all over the country. We checked in with forestry researcher Mike Dockery. He teaches at the University of Minnesota, and he's a member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. He told us that tribal members in the Great Lakes region have a spiritual connection to birch trees, and they use the bark to make canoes and baskets.
They were seeing changes in sort of the composition, and they were seeing some changes in kind of the bark, particularly in terms of bark that they could use for making canoes, large pieces of bark that they could get from the trees. Not only were they the first to pick up on the change in some of the birch resource, but they worked with our scientists to get a different perspective on how they could be doing inventories across the landscape.
Those observations led to a partnership between researchers, forest ecologists, and tribal members to do an inventory of birch and to understand how broadly this was happening across the region.
We started looking at actual bark characteristics and seeing how that changed. Because normally a forester will measure the size of the tree, the age of the tree, the height, the diameter. They will measure where it's growing, what are the neighbor trees doing. But this whole idea of walking into a forest and looking at trees in a different manner, how curved is the trunk, how flaky is the bark, how many lichens are growing on it, and what does that pattern look like?
Mike says looking at these different markers has allowed scientists to gain new perspectives on the impact of climate change. Mike Dockery is a forest researcher at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about trees, their role in our survival on the planet, and the threats they face. There's something one of the researchers said earlier that really stood out to me.
Preserving the stage, but recognizing that the actors are going to change.
Meaning we will still have forests, but we have to get used to new and different trees thriving in those forests. But when it comes to one especially iconic tree, the American chestnut, people are very reluctant to see it exit the stage. American chestnuts are all but gone, but some want to save these trees by all means. Should they? Liz Tung has more.
Now, I know that calling a tree majestic sounds kind of trite. But it was true for the American chestnut. We're talking trunks wider than five adults standing shoulder to shoulder. They had smooth grayish bark, chestnuts that grew in spiky burrs, and a leaf that looked like a long canoe.
It's tapered at both ends, and the sides of the leaves have a dentation that looked like a breaking ocean wave.
That's Sarah Fitzsimmons. She's the director of restoration at the American Chestnut Foundation. And she says these robust, beautiful trees once covered the eastern seaboard. Today, not so much.
I'd say most of your listeners probably have not seen an American chestnut.
In fact, these trees are so rare now that to find a good specimen, I took an hour's drive outside Philadelphia to visit a carefully tended orchard.
So this is the orchard, this fenced area right here. And we have about 130 examples of the American chestnut. So let's go and walk over here.
That's John Wenderoth. He's a board member with the American Chestnut Foundation, which helped start this orchard in 1997. And today, he's my tour guide, walking me through row upon row of leafless, spindly-looking little trees.
American chestnut. This is a tree that used to get to be anywhere from 5 to 9 feet in diameter. And it's been reduced to basically a shrub.
We walk over to one of the bigger ones, and John puts his hand on the trunk. He runs it over an orange patch where the bark has started to crack and is peeling away.
This is what the blight causes. Any place there's a wound, it can get into through the bark of this tree and cause these. These are called cankers. And these cankers are what are destroying the tree.
In fact, they're what destroyed most American chestnut trees. The chestnut blight first started showing up in the early 20th century. It was a fungus, apparently imported from overseas. Despite desperate efforts to stop the blight, it swept like wildfire across the country. By the 1940s, 99% of American chestnut trees had been wiped out. The American Chestnut Foundation was started in the 1980s to save the trees that remained, largely by crossbreeding them with Asian varieties. That required finding native chestnuts with at least some resistance to the blight, which John Wenderoth says hasn't been easy.
This one's cankered already and probably won't last long. There's so much disease in this orchard. If you could bring something in here and it would grow, it would be a miracle.
A miracle is exactly what the American Chestnut Foundation has been trying to achieve, which is why in 1989, in addition to their slower breeding efforts, they got in touch with Bill Powell and Chuck Maynard, both professors at the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry in New York. I talked with Bill.
And basically asked us, you know, is there another path forward? And we said, well, yes, people are starting to develop genetic engineering with trees.
The idea was to take a more targeted approach, to add a single gene to the American chestnut that would protect it. So Bill started by figuring out the mechanism by which the fungus harms trees.
An acid called oxalic acid, or oxalate. And if you could get rid of that acid, it would no longer have a weapon to attack the tree.
Bill needed a gene that could break down oxalic acid. As it turned out, researchers had already found one, and they were using it to protect tomatoes and other crops.
And I asked, oh, can I get a copy of that gene? Because I want to try it out in chestnut. It was kind of the eureka moment that this would be the perfect gene for the American chestnut.
The gene is present in a lot of different crops. Bill settled on wheat because it was the most studied. But here's the thing. In order to get that wheat gene into the chestnut tree's genome, Bill and his colleagues had to create a way of growing chestnut trees from a single cell. That was the only way to ensure that as the chestnut embryo grew, every additional cell would have a copy of the wheat gene. And this was not easy. In fact, it took Bill and Chuck's team 16 years to develop a method that would work. Once they had that down, the next challenge was figuring out how to inject the wheat gene into their tiny little chestnut tree embryo. For that, they turned to a little helper called Agrobacterium.
It's a natural genetic engineer, and what this bacteria will do in the wild is put genes into plants.
So they put the wheat gene into the Agrobacterium, and then the Agrobacterium infects the chestnut cell, in the process delivering the wheat gene. So now that they had a process in place, they could start growing these genetically modified chestnut trees. They went through literally hundreds of these prototypes, testing each and every one to see how they would respond to the fungus, and then using the results to create new prototypes.
And the first ones that we put out when we tested, basically we found out that they died slower. So we knew we were kind of on the right track, but wasn't quite there yet.
So Bill and his colleagues continued to tweak, generation after generation, until finally, 3 years ago, they decided they'd gotten there. Its name is Darling 58, and Bill says they have a grand vision for its future, which is ultimately to release Darling 58 into the forests, and hopefully for it to spread, bringing the American chestnut tree back from the brink of extinction. But releasing a genetically modified organism into the wild is a big deal. To get government approval, Bill and his team have needed to run tests showing that the tree won't harm or otherwise alter the local ecosystem. So far, Bill says the tests have all come back normal. The genetically modified trees seem to behave exactly the same as regular American chestnuts. But that hasn't prevented some serious backlash.
Our major concern with the genetically engineered American chestnut tree was this is the first time that genetic engineering was being applied to a tree with the intention of releasing it into the wild to spread itself.
That's Ann Peterman. She's the international coordinator of the Campaign to Stop Genetically Engineered Trees. Anne says their biggest concern is that the genetically engineered trait, that little wheat gene we talked about, either won't work or it could have unpredictable impacts on the tree's genome over the long haul.
There's just no way to know what these trees will do in that ecosystem over time because those risk assessments haven't been done and can't be done. They're not going to do risk assessments that are 50 years long or 100 years long. They want to get these trees out there as soon as possible with no idea what they'll do in the long term.
Bill obviously disagrees. His favorite argument? They're just doing the same thing that's already happening in nature. Remember the key to their genetic modification? How they used Agrobacterium to essentially Trojan horse the wheat gene into the chestnut embryo? Apparently, modern scientists aren't the only ones using it to change plant genetics.
Interestingly, this agrobacterium has basically transformed a lot of crops out in the wild.
Bill says one recent paper showed that agrobacterium has contributed to the genetic transformation of as many as 10,000 plant species out in the wild.
That's just mind-boggling. And you think, well, what would it matter if we put out a genetically engineered chestnut?
The two sides could go back and forth for days on this stuff. But in the end, I think they're actually having a bigger conversation. One that goes way beyond chestnut trees or genetic engineering. It's about what our role should be when it comes to nature. What's our responsibility? How far should we go? For Bill, the big dream is to release the genetically engineered chestnut tree back into the wild and see it flourish, which he says wouldn't just be good for the forests, but could open the door to reviving other species that have fallen by the wayside. Anne, however, is more cautious and less optimistic. In fact, she says focusing on the chestnut is missing the forest for the trees.
The forests have largely evolved beyond American chestnut trees. And at this point, forests have so many threats and so much pressure on them from climate change, from deforestation, from, you know, urban sprawl and suburban sprawl, that I feel like if we really want to protect the forests, the first thing we need to do is address the underlying causes of forest destruction.
Just to keep the deer out.
As we were leaving the chestnut orchard, Don Wenderoth, my tour guide, made another point.
Well, you know, in some ways, doing this, trying to recover this tree, it seems almost like a futile exercise, because we might bring it back into existence in a world it can't survive in.
It's a dark thought. But right now, here in the present, a handful of American chestnuts are surviving, finding a way to adapt against all the odds.
It's one of the things that encourages to bring this back, because you can see that they in some sense want to live.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. We're talking about trees and their role in our survival on the planet. Coming up, does it matter if a tree grows in a forest or on a farm?
So genetically, they're the same. But as far as what they do, you know, for their ecosystem, totally different.
Still to come on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about trees, their role in our survival on the planet, and the threats they face. North Carolina harvests about 4 million Christmas trees per year. 4 million. Most of them are Fraser firs. They have soft needles which don't shed as much as other evergreens, and the limbs are strong enough for ornaments. These firs do well on farms, but they're having a much harder time in the wild. Irina Zhurov takes us to North Carolina high country.
It's the first day of cutting on Joey Clausen's Christmas tree farm in the mountains outside Boone, North Carolina. Four workers, chainsaws in hand, pick their way through Fraser firs planted in neat rows. It takes just a few seconds to saw down each tree, which Joey has spent years pampering.
I've got about 95,000 trees.
For nearly a decade before harvest, workers fertilize each tree by hand, shaping them one by one with giant machetes, and, if needed, help them fight pests.
It's 4 or 5 months that I'm out here weekly with a magnifying glass checking bunches of trees in every field. That's a lot of hours that I'm spending taking care of my trees.
Pests have become a problem on the farms. They tend to be lower in altitude than where the trees naturally grow, which introduces different problems. If Joey spots an outbreak of various aphids, mites, hemlock scale, or the balsam woolly adelgid, he'll spray with insecticide. All in the name of a perfect Christmas tree.
Because it's all about creating family memories.
Millions of Fraser firs will grace people's homes this Christmas. But in the wild, the trees have become rarer. It's due to a bug called the balsam woolly adelgid. It can be controlled on a farm, but not in a forest. Biologist Howard Neufeld has witnessed the destruction these bugs cause firsthand. He says when he graduated high school in the 70s, he and two friends took a trip to the Smoky Mountains to hike.
When we did it in 1970, you walked through this dark, dank forest, you know, with Fraser firs and a couple spruce sticking up above you with moss on the ground and lichens hanging on branches. 10 years later, almost all those trees had died from the adelgid.
The balsam woolly adelgid injects a toxin into trees. That triggers abnormal growth and makes the trees unable to take up water, which eventually kills them. Howard says the bug arrived in the region after extensive logging at the turn of the 20th century. In a push to reinvent the area around tourism, wealthy landowners and the government decided to replant the highest peak in the Appalachians, Mount Mitchell.
And so, as the fashion was in those days, they imported trees from Europe, and one of them was silver fir. And the silver fir had this adelgid on it, and no one saw it.
It's tiny, only about the size of a grain of sugar. Slowly, it began to attack native fir trees. People started to notice it in the 60s, and die-off spread rapidly in the 70s and 80s.
It's had a devastating effect here.
In some native fir stands, the adelgid has killed more than 90% of the trees. But on Roan Mountain, a ridge in Tennessee about 6,000 feet high, a lot of firs still stand. Scott Corey, a PhD student studying Fraser firs, shows me around. We walk up a road littered with coyote poop, then climb a bank into the forest.
Oh, this is classic spruce fir forest. Dense, dense number of stems in here. Super dark in the understory. Everything's mossy.
We're in Appalachia, but it looks like the Pacific Northwest and feels like elves are watching from emerald mossy perches. The smell of Christmas is everywhere.
It smells so good.
I think that just working on Fraser fir for the past like 7 years, I'm kind of a Scrooge and I don't love the smell anymore.
Scott says this stand of firs is pretty special.
At the end of the last glaciation, 10 or 12,000 years ago, all this was a lot colder.
He says at that time, the firs lived all up and down the mountain.
But as it warmed up over the next 10,000 years, the trees had to move further and further to the top of the mountain.
Today, the Fraser firs live on just 7 mountain peaks in the southern Appalachians, and Roan Mountain is one of them.
Is there a difference between these trees that we're looking at and the trees on the farms?
So genetically, they're the same. But as far as what they do, you know, for their ecosystem, totally different.
Scott says the Fraser firs here are the basis of a whole ecosystem, which keeps the air and water clean, stores carbon from the atmosphere, and provides habitat for many animals like cute little owls and flying squirrels. Some flora and fauna, like a tiny endangered tarantula called the spruce fir moss spider, live only here. In other words, these native stands, they're wild, like, say, a lion prowling a savanna. The farm trees are more like a lion in the zoo. We come out of the forest and wander further up the road.
Okay, I think we're coming up on some classic ghost forest.
Scott spies a patch of firs that have been killed by the adelgid. They're barkless, their white trunk striking an otherwise dim wood.
There's one, a dead one. There's a dead one.
But on the forest floor, new firs have sprouted. The adelgid only affects older trees with cracked bark they can penetrate. These young saplings are protected by smooth bark, so they're safe, for now. The forest is recovering. It's unclear if these new firs will in time fall victim to the adelgid. Scott says he doesn't think the Adelgid will be the thing that wipes out these mountaintop Appalachian forests. But he's clear that this ecosystem, one of the most endangered in the U.S., is worth protecting.
That story was reported by Irina Zhorov. We're talking about trees, the threats they face, and the role they play in our survival on the planet. A lot of us live not close to a forest, but close to highways. Lots of highways. And the pollution from all of those cars can affect our health. Reporter Molly Samuel met an Atlanta researcher who is looking at how trees could help.
At a parking lot in Midtown with a close-up view of the downtown connector, Georgia State University professor Christina Fuller is getting an experiment going.
Setting up real-time monitoring instruments to monitor for very small particles called ultrafine particles. They're too small to be able to see, but they have an effect on health, and they're high close to roadways.
These tiny particles have been linked to heart disease and asthma. They can come from a variety of places, but car tailpipes are a big contributor. So Fuller is here to study how good trees are at reducing that pollution from this busy highway. In one place, this parking lot's exposed to the connector, but for a lot of it, big, glossy, dark green magnolias stand between her and the road.
One of the reasons why we picked this location is because it has these beautiful magnolia trees.
A pump rattles next to us, sucking up air from behind that row of magnolias. Fuller will also measure the air pollution next to the highway without the tree barrier. She hopes to figure out what kinds of trees are best at filtering ultrafine particles and use this research to help people who live near highways.
Because there's hundreds of thousands of people who live close to roads in the United States.
Fuller says historically, highways have gone through poorer communities and communities of color, which then bear the brunt of this kind of pollution. That's where her research focus has been, and those communities are still probably the most affected. But trees capture some of the ultrafine particles, and they can also force the particles to drop down out of the air onto the ground so they don't end up in people's lungs.
I tell people about the work that I'm doing. People say, oh, that makes sense, but I've never thought of that before. It's not in the conversation in larger built infrastructure. You just think of what you can build.
That is starting to change, though. Max Zhang is a mechanical engineering professor at Cornell University.
This is a movement that has gathered, you know, some pretty large momentum recently.
He's studying using trees as pollution barriers in Detroit, Oakland, and Louisville. And he says one important thing to remember is
design matters.
So it matters how the trees are planted. If there are gaps, for instance, the pollutants could just funnel through them. And local geography matters too. The same trees won't work as well everywhere. Christina Fuller is still working on her research, but she says at this point she knows. Evergreens like these magnolias and pine trees, those are some of the best since they can block pollution year-round.
Atlanta in particular has so many trees, and at the same time there's a lot of building going on. So when new buildings are being planned out, if we can keep some of those trees that are already mature in the building plans, then they can get the most benefit.
She says in the long run, she hopes her work will be used to inform policy and planning decisions.
That was Molly Samuel reporting. She's at WABE in Atlanta. California's forests have been through a lot over the years. Logging, droughts, beetle infestations, and recently, massive fires. And now people are looking for ways to return the woods to a more natural and more fire-resistant state. Daniel Marino has more.
In the eighth grade, my social studies teacher Ted Breese read us a poem. It was about his years working as an arborist in the Bay Area.
Around Francisco Bay, I'm called to cut trees every day. I love trees a lot, so I dwell on the thought. I'm a lumberjack, but I am okay.
His message was that sometimes things need a little attention to keep them healthy. And sometimes the best thing you can do for a tree and the people who live near it is to cut it down. As wildfires continue to get worse in California, many think it's time to take this same approach to the forests. Santa Rosa, a city north of San Francisco, has gone through two destructive fires in the last 3 years, the Tubbs Fire in 2017 and the Kincade Fire just 2 months ago.
Yeah, so this place is burned twice.
Yeah, so the area we're driving through right now was all burned in the Tubbs Fire. As you kind of
As we're heading north on the preserve, you can kind of see the fire intensity actually minimizes quite a bit.
Devin Friedfeld is the natural resource specialist at Pepperwood Preserve, a few thousand acres of rolling woods and grasslands. It burned in both the Tubbs and Kincaid fires.
And a lot of people have just finished building their homes after losing it in the Tubbs fire, and then the Kincaid fire happens. And you ask yourself, how many times can I do this?
There's a problem in California's forests. They are fueling more frequent and more dangerous fires than ever before. Climate change isn't helping things, but the problem really started with logging more than 100 years ago, when acre upon acre of old-growth forest was cut bare. Clear-cutting completely changed the structure of the forests, says John Bailey, a professor of forestry and fire management at Oregon State University.
A lot of it was converted to single-aged plantation-style forest.
After the clear-cutting, what regrew was all the same age, mostly the same size, and really close together. These forests, if not natural, were valuable, and fire was the enemy.
The Forest Service as an agency, but also other agencies, really honed in the professional skills around fire management, and fire management dominantly being suppression.
To protect the forests and the homes near them, forest fires were being snuffed out like never before. But that had unintended consequences, says ecologist Michael Loik of UC Santa Cruz.
That led to a lot of overgrowth of forests and shrublands.
According to Keith Gillis, a forester at UC Berkeley, fire is a necessary part of the ecosystem. Take it away and things get out of balance.
Fire is really the ecological driver. If you manage to suppress the driver of the system, ultimately, there'll be some kind of release.
Fast forward 50 years, add climate change, a few decades worth of dense undergrowth, and 15 or 20 million people to California, and we're starting to see those releases in the form of massive fires. So what do we do? Fix the forests? Well, yeah, actually. Ecosystems that are a mix of big trees, open undergrowth, and grasslands, basically old-growth forests, simply don't burn like the dense, overgrown forests of today. There is no way to snap your fingers and get the old growth back, but it is possible to mimic and promote those conditions through smart thinning and controlled burning.
Can you walk up to where you were doing?
Yeah.
Walking up a hill at Pepperwood with Devin Friedfeld, I didn't know I was standing in a living example of what thinning and burning look like.
Pepperwood was fortunate enough to be one of the areas that did get a little double burn.
Some parts burned first in the Tubbs fire 2 years ago, and again this year in the Kincaid fire. It was the perfect natural experiment for the fire treatment and thinning.
Did the double burned areas burn less?
So we're standing in the double burned area right now.
Oh, wow.
So the two areas that didn't burn in the Tubbs fire actually burned really intense in the Kincaid fire, especially compared to other areas on the preserve that the Tubbs fire had already come through.
Devin was careful to point out that the evidence is anecdotal until it's been studied, but you could feel the difference. In the double burn areas, trees were a little scorched and a bit brown around the edges, but otherwise alive and well. Areas that hadn't burned in 2017 were still full of fuel when the Kincaid fire came through this year. And those areas burned hot. Trees were often nothing more than a ghostly pile of ash on the ground. Pepperwood is a living example of what many scientists, conservationists, and land managers have long known. To restore the health of California's forests and protect the people that live near them, we need to manage the wildlands with fire and thinning.
Indigenous people lived on this land for thousands and thousands of years, sure. And they stewarded the land. So it's really only in almost this recent history that this stewardship has been lost. And it feels like in kind of this new generation of environmentalism is taking on this stewardship role.
And just like my teacher, Mr. Brees, told me so many years ago, sometimes you need to do a little trimming if you want to keep a tree or even a whole forest healthy.
Some trees I trim for the site, or to make people safer at night. But the health of the tree is important to me. I'm a lumberjack, and I'm all right. Forests are great places to play.
That story was reported by Daniel Marino.
We have to protect them from the saws of the madmen. I'm a lumberjack, and I'm okay. Trees in the city make air, in the forest.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about trees. What do you do when your beautiful trees are being choked by vines? A few months ago, reporter Jessica Korkunas moved from a Philadelphia row home to a much bigger property a couple of miles away. With this new property came a lot more land, and that meant caring for trees. But first, she had to figure out what was a tree and what was vines.
Our new spot is a lot like having our own private park in the city. When I first saw this mini forest, I was in awe of the vines climbing up and draping off the giant trees. But that quickly turned to concern as I realized that this is probably not a good thing. I asked Karen Flick, landscape manager from the nearby Aubrey Arboretum, to come visit in order to get a better idea of what we were dealing with.
Going by the looks of them, they're all considered a heritage tree, so they're very valuable for the environment.
In terms of years, what is a heritage tree?
Probably close to 100 years or older.
Wow. This one in particular,
yes,
has now become almost a different plant because of the vine.
It sure is. And most people looking at that would think the branches coming off it are actually the tree itself. It looks like it's an oak, but it's covered all the way up just about to the tip of the branches in English ivy. So it almost looks like a green sculpture.
I do think the ivy is beautiful. But my oak is being choked by this vine.
It's compromised now. Now the English ivy will actually grow into the bark of the tree. It will weaken the tree, and really it's a hazardous tree at this point. It's completely covered.
So do you feel like it's past being able to be saved?
I would never want to say that. It is dangerous and something does need to be done about it.
What exactly needs to be done is the question here. How can we free my trees? The answer to me is obviously goats.
So we have brothers Teddy and Ray. They're Nubian goats. And
then enter Karen Krivett from the Philly Goat Project. One of the things this project does is rent out their goats for grazing.
The goats are here to eat, which is what they do best.
That's Karen's daughter, Lily Sage. They run the goat project together.
They'll eat 25% of their body weight every day in roughage, and they can eat things like poison ivy. So if the goats are able to clear off the majority of the English ivy at the base and part of the mid shaft of the tree, then crews can come in and much more easily identify what vines need to be cut and tear them down.
Karen says the goats are kind of like weed whackers.
Revealing what's underneath, kind of like taking the clothes off the tree.
As the day wore on, two goats got full and were swapped out for four smaller goats. Some were wearing sweaters, and at that point, I nearly died from all the cuteness. My trees were quickly coming into view from underneath the ivy. I could see the heavy trunks of the vines weaving their way and squeezing the bark of my trees. As the goats finished grazing, I stood next to Lily, and we looked out at the trees.
Each one has a bunch of other trees around it. They're sort of in conversation with one another. And they all kind of dance around the house, which is a really lovely way to live. It is like in a tree dance party. So it would be a real shame for any of them to fall or need to be removed from the party.
Now that the goat's job is done, the trees are one step closer to freedom. With the leaves stripped and eaten, a landscaper can chop the vines at their base and the trees will dance on.
That was Jessica Korkunas. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jed Slayman, and Steph Yin. Our intern is Grant Hill. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.